We're on a mission to help founders hit product market fit faster. We do this by interviewing founders that have been there. I'm your host, Adam O'Donnell. This podcast is put together by Zendesk for Startups. We offer 6 months free of Zendesk customer support suite for qualified product-oriented companies.
Daniel, welcome to Sit Down Startup Founder Podcast. Really excited to hear your story building AppDirect and then, of course, what you're working on with Landbase. It sounds like it could be an interesting thing for us to consider at Zendesk. But all of that aside, tell me when you first realized that you wanted to become a founder.
From my earliest memories, I wanted to start a business and be entrepreneurial. You know, some of my earliest memories were coming up with business ideas, and I didn't know that it would be a technology business, but always was entrepreneurial.
Interesting. So it was like teenage years before that, like you're like, I just want to build stuff.
Yeah, like 8 years old, I built a city that I wanted to envision that we create, which involved like different retail, hospitality, casino involved. And like I built it out of like cutouts, and my parents woke up the next morning. I stayed up all night doing it and they thought I was crazy. I think they were concerned for me and my future.
I love stories like that. You were just like, I see cities. How can we make them better? I got an idea right now.
Yeah.
On your journey building AppDirect, like first, like if, for anyone who doesn't know, how much money did you end up raising in that journey? How big is the company now?
Yeah. So AppDirect's over 1,000 people. We raised over $500 million over unicorn valuation and have been really transformative to supporting millions of businesses around the world adopt technology, including Zendesk. So really proud of what we've been able to do for the world of entrepreneurship and businesses.
That's so cool. And then at Landbase, what are you building now for anyone who doesn't know?
So I've recently founded Landbase and launched Landbase just to really solve the biggest pain point I ever had, which was generating predictable pipeline or demand. And I think the hardest part of building a business is being able to have repeatable pipeline so you can predict revenue and grow. And with advancements in AI, particularly agentic AI that takes action based on data on your behalf, there's the potential to completely transform the way businesses go to market.
That is exciting. I want to hear more about that as we continue, but thank you. So just going back to AppDirect, help us with one of the lower moments that you had on that journey to really let all the founders know who are in that moment right now that they're not alone.
So back then, I think things moved a lot slower than they do today, because now there's this whole infrastructure, both venture capital, but as well as books and awareness around what startups are all about. Back then, I don't even think the Lean Startup book was written or 0 to 1. So you were kind of just guessing as you go. But we spent about a year to like kind of get to the point that we could sell our first customer, a year to sell them, a year to get through legal, and then then we launched. So this was like everything was riding on this deal. It was a Canadian telco, and the whole team was working 3 years. Just for this launch. And because it was like one of the biggest companies in Canada, they said like, we're going to put this on billboards. We're going to have this on advertisements. There's going to be so much traffic that it's going to break your site. So literally, I remember working really hard getting all of the apps in our app store, because AppDirect helped essentially allow businesses to find, buy, and use SaaS and technology applications. So worked really hard to get an initial set of maybe 10 applications in the store. And the last like sprint before the launch, like we were like 72 hours under a desk, like troubleshooting everything, making sure everything was great so we could have huge scale. One of our early apps was Shopify, and they were in their infancy as well. Harley, who's still the president of Shopify, kind of engaged in that opportunity. So we pressed this button, and kind of it was just when the Facebook movie came out. So you think all of a sudden like millions of people are going to come. We press the start button. There's this music. We all celebrate. We all pass out. The next morning, we expect to see like hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of visitors, and literally like zero, like crickets. And we thought like it was a bug. So the next week we were like, what's going on? Like literally no one is coming to the site. And then like a month goes by, and you know, maybe there's a few, but Harley from Shopify sends me a message going, WTF, my intern's blog has more traffic than this app store. So we could have packed in the business. I also hadn't built pipeline. So literally that was the only client we had writing for us. But I think anyone else would have given up, but me and my co-founder kind of broke it down to first principles. We said like, look, we think that the idea of adopting cloud technology is still going to work. We just have to think through how we take it to market. And because of that persistence and because of the launch, we actually got notoriety from other telecoms like AT&T and Telstra and SoftBank all around the world. And we were able to turn that into success, but it took many years to have repeatability and to even validate that we had product market fit.
I bet. And thank you for sharing that. Those moments are just so painful, because you do compare it to the movie, and you also compare it to the occasional, maybe I would say 1 in 10 founders that I talked to, like they did have that initial hockey stick right off the bat. It's so much more rare than we realized.
Yeah, I think you mentioned the applicability of product market fit in this podcast. And I think product market fit is very difficult because you can have it or you can think that you have it and then it goes away. So I don't think it's something that like you have or you don't. A lot of people think that like you're searching for this thing, product market fit. And once you find it, then you can scale really seamlessly. Things change all the time. So I co-ran AppDirect for about 15 years. I've been in technology for a long time and I've seen a lot of companies fail because they think they have product market fit and then, you know, things turn sideways. So I always think that like it's day one for any founder at any point, just trying to both identify like first you have the product message fit. So does the pain point that you're trying to solve resonate with your target persona? But I think more so than focusing on product market fit, I feel like you need to continuously test or gut check your conviction for your vision and make sure that on a first principles basis, the world's moving in your direction. Because we launched these stores. So the first one didn't succeed, but the next few we got going. But it still took till year 7 of our business to move the key metric that we got, which was gross merchandise value, which was the aggregate transaction volume of people selling on our stores. And I remember for the first years of the business, that number was at 0. And we could have said like, this thing's never going to work, let's give up. But you know, we had conviction and it went from 0 to 100 when we sold our first subscription. And then it was 1,000 and then it was 10,000 and it was 100,000. Now it's in the billions, but things compound. So I think that you really have to go back to look at micro validation that your ideas are working. And if you continue to kind of motivate yourself, not just on what you see today, but on what you forecast, that's, I think, how you can drive game-changing business.
It's getting away from chasing that like massive hit moment where everything shuts down and more like, is what we're doing actually where things are going, and then just working slowly in that direction consistently.
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, you need urgency, especially if you're in a competitive market. That being said, some things that are very hard to innovate on take many, many years to build. I was just with a friend who's at Oklo. So it's like a fishing company and they've been at it for many years. And for them to get to commercialization, it might be another 10 years, but you got to look at all the proof points. You got to make the right investments. You got to articulate to your investors, you know, where you see the opportunity plus risk factors. And amazing things might take 5-10 years to manifest. So I think we get into this world of instant gratification, looking at everyone raising all the money and looking at everyone showing all these great metrics. But I think you have to be more intrinsic about your success versus just getting FOMO from all the stories out there that I think for any successful headline, you're going to have dozens or 100 that don't go that way.
100%. How did you get to conviction with AppDirect? What did that look like? Maybe you could take us into that.
Honestly, we always had a burning desire that SaaS would work, which at the time, like a lot of people didn't believe that SaaS would be adopted. And then I grew up in a family business. It was a furniture store in Niagara Falls, Canada. It was around for 100 years, started by my great grandparents. And we had to shut it down in the Great Recession just as when I was graduating. And kind of the whole impetus for starting AppDirect was that on one hand, you had these great solutions like MailChimp or Dropbox or Shopify that could be transformative to businesses. On the other hand, all the businesses on Main Street were going under because they didn't have access to these tools. So my founding belief was that businesses want to buy software from people they trust. And therefore, there needs to be a channel for people to find software from a trusted provider. And to this day, I still believe that. And now it's proven out, you know, in huge space. But at the time, a lot of people really didn't think that was possible. In fact, sometimes I think today, what I'm shocked about is like even laggards or people who wouldn't typically be so tech-centric, they're all embracing AI. It's rare that I ever have anyone say, oh, I don't think AI is going to work, or I don't want to try AI. So I feel like in many ways, I get freaked out a little bit in this environment because it's too easy. Everyone is kind of agrees with everything I'm saying. So I almost wonder if it's going to be a heavily, you know, competitive space, or it seems a little weird to me because I'm so used to facing extreme rejection.
That's a really interesting shift. I'm sure it has other challenges, but that's really cool to hear. Help me with this. What were you doing before AppDirect, just for anyone who doesn't know?
Just out of school.
And so for you to make the decision to go all in was probably a lot easier than someone who had a full-time paycheck. But if you wanted to share what that was like to go all in to start AppDirect.
So like I said, from the earliest memories, I wanted to start a business. When I went to college, what I thought is that in order to start a business, you needed to raise capital. And in order to raise capital, you needed to have a pedigree behind you. So therefore, you had to go into investment banking or consulting to build a track record. And when the recession hit, none of those jobs were available. It's like, okay, well, why don't I just start? And I'm a big proponent that the longer you wait in your career, the harder it is to start because you've already kind of been risk adjusted. So I do believe in kind of like the Peter Thiel like, hey, you can start at any time. I see founders even today that have 20 years less experience than me, and I'm blown away by their conviction and capability. So I think while I may have experience now from running a business for 15 years, I still think that someone who's young and doesn't know what they don't know can really outcompete.
Yeah, that's good. How are you spending your time the very first year of the business?
So Langbase has been around for about a year. Really, the first part was speaking to many businesses to identify their pain and match a technology shift to that pain. So I'd say that was the first couple months, which was really developing extremely deep conviction that what we're building is differentiated and kind of addresses huge pain points. It was easier for me because I felt the pain point on my own. I know some people call this eating their own dog food. We call it drinking your own champagne. I'd much rather celebrate and drink champagne than dog food, but I felt the pain, and I know many others that have felt the pain. So it was really uncovering how can this new technology shift meet the pain, and also going very deep on a first principles basis around what strategy will provide for a massive platform versus just a point solution app. So I think that because it's easier today than ever to build an application, and the cost of computing and the cost of launching and the capital availability has gone down, there's situations where for any one idea, you might have hundreds of funded ideas, maybe thousands of people working on it. So to me, the best businesses are built with a huge moat and with differentiation. So a lot of it was going many layers deeper than the obvious in how do we match a very difficult technology problem with an obvious market pain and make sure that we're servicing something that's very differentiated.
I love that because I think it's just so hard to stay differentiated in defendability from all the startups that I talked to. But I'm curious, how are you asking questions to get to that? Because I would imagine that you're talking to the prospect during a discovery interview and you're not thinking about defendability. You're just like, how do I hear their pain and then I match that. And then later you would match like the defendability as you scaled it. But I'm just curious if you could share your thought process there.
Yeah. So my co-founder, Emily, she wrote the case study on AppDirect from Harvard Business School. So she was an HBS grad and then went to run eBay's first AI and ML projects and then was early at Carta up to their like $8 billion round and then was on the co-founding team of Oyster as the head of product, which was one of the fastest unicorns. And her experience was just to develop broad a pain point. You want to speak to dozens and dozens of business owners and understand like what's the biggest pain point that they can express in their words. And then you want to identify like what's the new technology that wouldn't have been available last year, and maybe that isn't even available today, that you can use to address this. So for us, it was obvious that Gen AI was this fun, big unlock. And a lot of startups at the time were building wrappers around GPT using Gen AI. And our belief was that the next wave of big tech incumbents is going to be through agentic AI, not Gen AI. In my view, it's very easy for incumbent, like let's say Salesforce for CRM or whoever else is in a different category, to leverage Gen AI to outcompete any startup. So my feeling is that the opportunity where a startup can outcompete an incumbent is because there's going to be a big technological and business model shift. And the way I define agentic AI is like AI that takes action based on your behalf, based on data. And in that world, you no longer have to work for your software, but your software works for you. And that's something that was not obvious a year ago when we started. The term that people use today is AI agents. And now it almost seems like everyone knows about it. But a year ago, the term agentic AI or large action model, which is the type of models that enable this, there were barely any online mentions of it. So it's kind of wild to see how fast the market moves because I think now people hear those terms and understand them, whereas a year ago, like there's zero mention.
Very interesting. And so, yeah, you're saying that the defendability comes through the way that the actions are taken by the model versus just data?
Yeah. So I think today you need multiple modes to build a durable company. It could be a talent moat by hiring scarce resources that no one else can get. And that's exhibited by the talent war for the large language model companies going and getting like DeepMind people or their scarce resource. So I think you can have a people moat or team moat. You can have a data moat by knowing where to dig. Right now, a lot of the LLMs consume publicly available data, but there's potentially private available avenues to be able to get data to train models in unique ways that could be differentiating. There's a capital moat or brand moat, which is just getting there first and you know having really good marketing. But what I believe is that the strongest moats that build the most durable companies tend to be algorithmic in some capacity that creates a snowball effect. So if you think about Google with their eventual search algorithm, it became the last mover in search. Same thing with Facebook for social networking. Same thing with DoorDash for delivery of food, because their algorithm was really good at knowing how to get hot food to someone. And I think that we've thought about in this era is like, how can we have a algorithmic advantage based on our core applied models? And that's where kind of we're spending a lot of time on differentiation and focus. That means it may take us a little bit longer, but the end result is we should have something that is one of a kind and has an advantage and positions us to be potentially the last mover in the space.
Very interesting. Can we just dive a little bit more in like examples of the actions that would be taken just from just simple curiosity and like where that is going over, say, even the next 5 years in terms of the level of action that could be taken?
Yeah. So large language models that we're familiar with today, you can chat with and create text in natural language, but it doesn't have context to understand specific outcomes or predict specific outcomes. But you could use similar transformer technology and predictive models if trained with the right data to be able to predict outcomes. So therefore, the models have context not only to the language, also how to take a decision that's going to have a higher probability of driving a better result. So in the context of lead generation, there's a lot of AI SDR companies that are prompting LLMs that allows them to address natural language. But what we found is that if you're just prompting an LLM, you're going to have currently probably better than average to poor performance of a human. So the end result is pretty poor. What we found by training our model actually is that average human performance produces poor results. Average AI prompting performance produces poor results. Top human performance produces really, really good results. And if you can harness that top performance with machine intelligence, you can then scale to have like really amazing results. But what we found is that unless you can identify what that performing result is for a company, you can't prompt a model to kind of outperform or hence solve the product market fit problem for you. So in our case, what we're training the model to do is to predict and execute actions that are going to improve the end result, which would be generating a lead. And our AI is good at doing that from both a targeting perspective. So who should you be targeting? An omni-channel perspective. So which channel do you go, whether it's LinkedIn, email, phone, eventually we can do ads in other areas. And then what's the actual message that you send tailored to that specific buyer? And what's the right time to send that message? So all those things we've trained kind of our AI models on, and they can predict the right outcome, which you can't have from a language model. My belief is that, and you're seeing it already, is that in every category in which there's a manual repetitive process across many fragmented systems, so any category there, you'll have the potential for there to be a specialized model that can predict outcomes. You'll probably see it already for life sciences and climate tech, and you might see it for support or legal or finance, subsets of that. And I think those are going to be really durable companies that have a hard time, that will be able to compete with like a Blue Ocean or a new market relative to people who are just prompting a language model.
That is really intriguing. And I love the top performer piece because that is a real challenge. I mean, companies can have a hard time even identifying within their own talent base who the top performers are. Obviously, the information is there and you can find it like within a company context, but that's a really interesting challenge.
Yeah, we trained our model. So our model is called GTM1 Omni, and we trained it with 175 million contacts, 22 million businesses, millions of ratings and reviews. We have agents to crawl and scrape different data, but we also trained it on 40 million campaigns. And there were a ton of like breakthrough insights that we had just from training this model. The first is that 45% of campaigns fail to generate leads that convert. Like that's wild. That means half of campaigns that go out just full out fail. But that directly correlates with when we spoke to business owners. So we spoke to all these business owners and they'd say, I hired an agency, generated a ton of irrelevant messages, waste of time, fired it. Or I used some tech tool, whether it was Clay or Apollo or whatever else. It was too technical or I couldn't figure it out, never got it to work, didn't have the time. So I stopped that. That happens a lot. So what we actually did is we created the first of its kind machine learning score, which can predict as a business based on your URL, your go-to-market readiness or your digital credibility. And what this score does is for any business, you can go to our website and kind of fill out the assessment, we'll give you a score. But what it does is it predicts your go-to-market efficiency. And what we found is that most, let's say, offline businesses, as well as most startups that are pre-Series B would score out of 100, about a 30 or below, which means it's really a waste of your money and time to do outbound. It's probably a good proxy for product market fit. So if you have a bad score, we actually can give you ways to improve that score. And that hopefully saves startups a ton of money from hiring an SDR or an agency or investing in tech tools where they would have had lack of success anyway.
Very neat. Definitely check that out. And that aligns perfectly with what we're doing right now for anyone who's trying to gauge where they actually are on product market fit. This has been amazing. One of the last questions is, what's like the biggest insight that you've learned that you would do differently?
I think it's that you need to have even more confidence and conviction in your vision. I'd say like there are days when 100 things go wrong and it's very hard to stay motivated. There are weeks when 100 things go wrong and you think that things are falling off the cliff. But I think as a founder, a lot of it is managing your psychology, and it's not obvious to be able to kind of see this future that you're envisioning when everyone's telling you that future is wrong. So I think that what would have gotten me there faster both times, and I'm even feeling this now, is if I would have, facing rejection, understood it, taken the feedback, deflected it, and not let it take me away from the ball. Whereas what I find is that sometimes if you have days or weeks or even months of bad feedback, you think everything's going wrong and you may feel differently about the ultimate outcome. So my view would just be meditate, make sure that you're just always thinking about first principles, be really accepting of feedback, and use that to adjust, but really always kind of pump yourself up. Because if you're truly doing something transformative, most people in the world are not going to understand it and they're going to have rejection. I assume that the bigger the final outcome as a company correlates heavily to the rejection you face. And some of the best entrepreneurs that I know that have done the most game-changing things are people who face the most rejection.
That's incredible. And the top vision that you started this episode out with around predictable pipeline, businesses are never going to not want to have that. So it's a matter of like the approach that you're doing and just like remembering that.
Yeah, the advice that I would have for any founder is really get conviction in your vision. And it does take time. When you have that, have clarity of how you measure that in the long run. So for AppDirect, it was gross merchandise value, which we said is a factor of reach times conversion times retention. So how many businesses do we reach through our channel partners or stores, times conversion, so how many apps are they buying, times retention, so how much do they stay and buy more. And it took a long time to move any of those levers. But if you brought it back from a first principles perspective, it all made sense to me why you could generate billions of GMV in a 10-year horizon, which we did. And I think with land-based, similarly, our core KPI is the number of leads generated per customer per month. And you know that's going to start from zero, but what we always want to focus on is how do we move that metric, which is going to make things better for everyone. So I think that go ahead and meditate or speak to your co-founders, go outside of the office, have total conviction in your long-term vision, have a way of tracking it, understand that it's going to take mountains to move those metrics. And then when you face rejection, go back to the blank piece of page and say, is what I'm learning making it that it's impossible to move this metric? Or is it just giving me one thing I've learned that will get me closer to that metric?
That is, it's just like keeping that the North Star and being disciplined around that. This has been amazing. If I'm a founder, I want to reach out to you. I know you're busy, but would the best channel for you be X or LinkedIn in those two?
Yeah, you can go to LinkedIn, fairly active there. So feel free to message me on LinkedIn. So it's at Daniel Sachs. I also have a website, www.danielsachs.ai. You can also go to Landbase. And if you put in your email, we'll follow up with a trust score. And that is a good way to gauge your go-to-market efficiency and product market fit and readiness.
Definitely check that out. Daniel, thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening. If you want to learn more about Zendesk for Startups, check out our website, zendesk.com/startups. Also, we're always looking to improve, so don't hesitate to email me with any feedback on how we can ask better questions, guests to target, or anything else that we can do to better help you as a founder. My email is adam.odonnell@zendesk.com.